deductions and credits for investing in solar heating, oil and gas, coal, hydroelectric power, and windmills, and even for electric vehicles. No matter what business you choose, there are tax benefits available to you. And it doesn't even matter what country you live or work in. All countries provide tax benefits to entrepreneurs. All it takes is for you to get a basic education of how the tax law works and to find a good tax advisor to work through the details. Some of the best tax incentives are in Europe, Australia, France, and the UK. There are tax incentives for businesses in Russia, China, and Japan as well. When I plan to visit a new country, I look up the tax laws, and one thing is consistent. Tax laws everywhere benefit the entrepreneur. And when you are paying less in taxes, you have more money to invest in your business. When you are an entrepreneur and use the tax laws the way they were intended to be used, taxes can truly make you rich. About Tom Wheelwright, CPA. Tom Wheelwright, CPA, is the creative force behind ProVision, the world's premier strategic CPA firm. As the founder and CEO, Tom has been responsible for innovating new tax, business, and wealth consulting and strategy services for ProVision's premium clientele for over two decades. Tom is a leading expert and published author on partnerships and corporation tax strategies, a well-known platform speaker, and a wealth education innovator. Donald Trump selected Tom to contribute to his Wealth Builders program, calling Tom the best of the best. Robert Kiyosaki, best-selling author of Rich Dad Poor Dad, calls Tom a team player that anyone who wants to be rich needs to add to his or her team. In Robert Kiyosaki's book, The Real Book of Real Estate, Tom authored chapters 1 and 21. He is a significant contributor to Robert Kiyosaki's new book, Why the Rich Are Getting Richer, and has also contributed to Who Took My Money and Unfair Advantage. Tom has written several articles for publication in major professional journals and online resources, and has spoken to thousands throughout the United States, Canada, Europe, and Australia. He has also used his superior relationship and team-building skills to advise the Canadian market in the art of investing in the United States by contributing to Philip McKernan's South of 49, and contributed heavily to his newest book, Fire Sale. For more than 30 years, Tom has devised innovative tax, business, and wealth strategies for sophisticated investors and business owners in the manufacturing, real estate, and high-tech fields. His passion is teaching these innovative strategies to the thousands who come to hear him speak. He has participated as a keynote speaker and panelist in multiple roundtables and led groundbreaking tax discussions challenging the status quo in terms of tax strategies. Tom has a wide variety of professional experience, ranging from Big Four accounting, where he managed and led professional training for thousands of CPAs at Ernst & Young's National Tax Department in Washington, D.C., to in-house tax advisor for Pinnacle West Capital Corporation, at the time a Fortune 1000 company. Tom also served as an adjunct professor in the Masters of Tax program at Arizona State for 14 years, where he created the course for teaching multi-state tax planning techniques and taught hundreds of graduate students. For more information on Tom's books, please see companion file number 18. An excerpt from Tax-Free Wealth, How to Build Massive Wealth by Permanently Lowering Your Taxes, by Tom Wheelwright, CPA.
Chapter 23. Choose the right tax advisor and preparer. Day in and day out, your tax accountant can make or lose you more money than any single person in your life, with the possible exception of your kids. That's from Harvey McKay. The first time I learned about the tax law was in my business law course in college. One of the local bankruptcy judges taught the course. He was a terrific instructor, and I loved the class. I especially loved learning about how vague the law can be. I'd learned many years earlier that something vague allowed for much more flexibility than something specific and certain, and I liked knowing that the law was flexible. Like most children, I discovered early on how to manipulate my parents. Sometimes that meant using my mother to persuade my father to let me go somewhere he might not otherwise have allowed. Other times, that meant pretending not to hear when they wanted me to do something. Most of the time, it simply meant twisting the meaning of what they told me into what I wanted to hear. Then, after I did something they didn't like, I used their words to convince them they'd really allowed me to do it. Perhaps I was always meant to study the law so that I could use it to my client's advantage. That first business law class really set me on my path to studying the tax law. I was so excited to learn the law that my junior year I signed up to take all of the tax classes available at the University of Utah School of Business. Most of my classmates were waiting to take their tax classes until their senior year, but those classes were so interesting to me that I couldn't wait. To do this, I had to push all of my other upper division accounting classes to my senior year. I even remember taking both intermediate accounting courses the same semester so that I could fit all those upper level classes in as a senior. All that work was worth it to me. The U Business School had a terrific tax professor, Professor Haney. He was a tax attorney who practiced law full time and taught tax classes on the side. He was demanding, but he understood the law well and was enthusiastic about the subject. When I was thinking about graduate school, the first person I talked to other than my wife was Professor Haney. I asked him whether I should go to law school or get a master's degree in tax accounting. He told me that if I wanted to spend most of my time working in tax law, I would be better off practicing as a certified public accountant. In his experience, CPA spent more time doing tax work than lawyers. So on Professor Haney's advice, I applied to the University of Texas Masters of Professional Accounting program. Since then, I have devoted my life to studying the tax law, teaching the tax law, and using the tax law to help my clients reduce their tax burdens. And taxes really are a burden. As Benjamin Franklin once said, quote, "It would be a hard government that should tax its people one-tenth part of their income," end quote. And yet governments throughout the world now routinely take 40 to 50% of a person's income. If you haven't noticed yet, I'm pretty passionate about reducing taxes, and passion is the most important element in reducing your taxes. Which brings us to rule number 21. The more passionate you and your advisor are about reducing your taxes, the lower your taxes will be. Every time I speak at a seminar, I'm asked the same question over and over again. How do I find a good tax advisor? This is one of the most important questions you can ever ask. A good tax advisor will not only help you reduce your taxes, but he'll take the fear out of taxes as well. And most importantly, he'll take the fear out of a tax audit. But being passionate about reducing your taxes is only one of the traits to look for in a good tax advisor. Another is how the advisor looks at the tax law. Is the advisor afraid of the law, or does he look at it as an opportunity? Most tax accountants are afraid of the law. They won't even read it. Instead, they read an abbreviated version of the law, such as a simple tax guide. These accountants shy away from anything they don't understand, and they don't understand much. They shy away from the law because they have never taken the time to learn the law. There is as wide a variety of education among tax advisors and tax preparers as there is among doctors, lawyers, and other professionals. Some tax preparers have only taken a few hours or a few weeks of courses to learn how to prepare tax returns. Others have some schooling, though not very much. It's only the best advisors who have graduated at the top of their classes from the best universities who really understand the tax law. The reason they attended the top schools and graduated at the top of their classes is that they wanted to learn the tax law and all of its intricacies. Like me, they crave learning about the law. The hierarchy of tax preparers is pretty simple. It's based on their level of education, both formal and practical. Chart number 31 in the companion files illustrates this point. As a result, most accountants, those with less education and understanding, will only take the most obvious deductions and tax benefits when they prepare your returns. And likely, you'll only talk to them once or twice a year because they don't have much to tell you. They're likely to make suggestions like maximizing your IRA, RRSP, or 401k contribution. They'll tell you to prepay expenses at the end of the year, or they'll suggest waiting until a later year to receive some income that you're owed. What terrible advice. Did you notice how all of this advice is about saving taxes now at the cost of having to pay them later? These accountants are all about tax savings now at the cost of your future. Once, during a training meeting, I asked our staff to explain what's different about Provision from other CPA firms. Our youngest staff member, right out of college, gave the most insightful answer. She said that she never expected to be working for a firm that focuses on its clients' future rather than dwelling on their past. One of the reasons most tax preparers don't focus on permanent tax savings is because they are only focused on the past and the present. They aren't taking into account your future. Why do people hire accountants and advisors with such little understanding? Maybe it's because they don't know what to look for in a tax advisor. Or maybe it's just because these preparers and advisors tend to charge less money for their work. What a mistake to hire someone because they charge less than somebody else. This brings us to rule number 22. It's not how much your tax preparer charges you that matters. It's how much your tax preparer costs you. Let me give you an example. One of our clients, let's call her Jill, recently reminded me about the amount of taxes we save her each year. Because of our understanding of the law, we've been able to save her $70,000 each year. Invested at 10% over 20 years, that amounts to about $4 million in money that she wouldn't have had if she'd stayed with her previous tax advisor. In other words, her previous tax advisor cost her $4 million over the previous 20 years. Yes, he charged less than my firm Provision. We charged about $20,000 to do the tax planning for Jill. But that $20,000 was the best investment Jill has ever made. Her return on investment, ROI, amounts to 350% per year. And since these are income taxes she is getting back, they aren't even taxable. How would you like a 350% tax-free return on a $20,000 investment? Chart number 32 in the companion files graphically illustrates this concept. Not every client is going to save $70,000 each year in taxes. Some will save more and some will save less. And fees vary from client to client as well. The key here is to ask which accountant cost Jill more money. The one whom she paid less and who cost her $4 million, or the one whom she paid more and saved $70,000 per year. Pretty obvious, isn't it? Yet most people continue to look at how much their preparer charges rather than how much their tax preparer costs them in excess taxes. Another tendency for tax accountants is to look at the law as if it runs in a straight line. We call these types of folks linear or left-brain thinkers. Most accountants are like this. They decided to be accountants because they like the certainty and clarity of figures. They generally don't become accountants because they like the vagueness of the law. These tax accountants do okay with routine work, such as preparing an accurate tax return. What they won't do is figure out creative ways to use the law in your favor. The challenge is that accountants don't write the tax law. Good tax lawyers, hired by congressmen and MPs, members of parliament, write the law to carry out those politicians' desires to improve the economy, encourage certain industries, and maintain government revenues. These lawyers tend to not think in a straight line. They're what we would call nonlinear or right-brain thinkers. The tax laws aren't written in a straight line. The rules of one section of the law will impact the rules of another section of the law, and the connection isn't always obvious. On top of this, there are many interpretations of the law that come from judges in court cases. It's critical that your tax advisor looks at all of the law when figuring out how to best reduce your taxes. If he or she only looks at a single rule, he or she could easily miss out on four or five other rules that could save you money. Here's a word of caution. Not all tax advisors are created equal. Tax advisors vary in knowledge and experience even more than healthcare professionals. Your tax bill will have more to do with choosing your tax advisor than anything else you do. Of course, the most important trait for your tax advisor is that he or she cares more about you than he or she does about himself or herself. How can you know this? It's simply a matter of whether he or she spends most of the time in your interview answering your questions and talking about himself or herself and his or her services, or whether he or she is more focused on what you need. Let me share a story to illustrate this principle. A while back, I was having lunch with one of my colleagues at a neighborhood cafe. I looked at the menu and found a sandwich that looked tasty. I also noticed on a menu that a pickle came with the sandwich. For those of you who enjoy eating pickles, you probably like getting one with your sandwich. But for those of us who don't like pickles, getting one with our sandwich can be devastating. Pickles are very social. They don't stay in one place. Instead, the juice runs all over, infecting the sandwich and anything else on the plate. I'm sure this is great if you enjoy the pickle flavor, but if you don't, just having a pickle on the plate can ruin the entire meal. Naturally, when our server took our order, I asked if she could please make sure they didn't put a pickle on my plate. Of course, she said, no worries. Still, I was worried. So I asked her about it again when she brought our drinks. She assured me that she'd make sure I didn't get a pickle on my plate. A few minutes later, she brought us our orders. I looked at mine. There was a sandwich, some French fries, and a pickle. I was confused. Why did I get a pickle on my plate after asking twice not to get one? Was I not nice enough? I thought I was nice enough. Did she forget? Did the cook just ignore her? As my colleague and I sat there, we wondered what we could learn from this situation. Why did I end up with a pickle on my plate? Our conclusion was that the cook or the server must have been too busy with their normal routine to do something outside of it. How could this tragedy have been avoided? Okay, so it wasn't that much of a tragedy. We thought and thought, and then it came to us. What if our server had asked me if I wanted a pickle? Would I have gotten one? Of course not, because that would have meant that it was in their routine to find out exactly what the customer wanted. The same is true when you are interviewing a tax advisor. If the tax advisor's routine is for you to ask all the questions, he will and can only respond to your questions. He can't find out anything you don't volunteer. If instead his routine is to ask you questions about your situation, you can be pretty sure that he'll be looking out for you and what you really want. Not only that, but the tax you pay depends entirely on your facts and circumstances. Remember my saying that any expense can be deductible in the right situation? If your situation changes, then your tax will change. If your tax advisor is not asking you questions about your situation, how can he or she possibly know what the tax consequences will be to you? He or she certainly won't be able to show you how to change your situation so that you receive better tax results. The reality is that you have all of the answers. Your advisor should have all of the questions. Don't worry about what questions you should ask your tax advisor. If you have to ask the questions, then you simply have the wrong advisor. Here's the tax tip. Hire the right tax advisor. This doesn't just require knowing the right questions to ask a potential tax advisor. It means knowing what questions your tax advisor should be asking you. Also, remember that only you can reduce your taxes. You have to learn enough about how the tax law applies to you so that you can use it to your benefit every minute of every day. Be sure to find a tax advisor who is willing and able to teach you the rules you need to know in order to reduce your taxes. Many advisors don't actually want you to know the rules. They're afraid that if you know the rules, you won't need their advice. We both know that's not right. If you know the rules, you'll be more successful at reducing your taxes. When you reduce your taxes, you'll increase your cash flow. When you increase your cash flow, you'll increase your wealth. And when you increase your wealth, you're likely to need your tax advisor even more than you do now. So it's really in your tax advisor's best interest to take the time to teach you the rules you need to know. It's certainly in your best interest. Here are the characteristics of a good tax advisor. Number one, they're fully educated about the tax law. Number two, they're passionate about reducing your taxes. Number three, they embrace the law as an opportunity. Number four, they focus on permanent tax savings. Number five, they use creativity in applying the law in your favor. Number six, they consider the entire tax law when reducing taxes, not just a single rule of law. Number seven, they care more about you than themselves. Number eight, They ask you questions about your specific situation. And number 9, they're willing to teach you the tax rules. The last piece of advice I would give you here is to find a tax advisor who will also prepare your taxes. Don't use a tax preparer who isn't also your tax advisor. If you do, it can be a huge mistake. You could get great advice, and then the preparer might not know how to use this advice in preparing your tax return. You want to be sure that your preparer isn't just accurate. He or she should also be working to reduce your taxes as he or she prepares your return, and he or she should be reducing your chances of being audited. At my firm, we look at tax return preparation as both the final step in last year's tax planning and the first step in next year's tax planning. Take the time to look for a good tax advisor who can also prepare your tax returns. Prepare for your interview with a prospective advisor by noting the major points we've discussed in this chapter. Here are the technical characteristics of a good tax advisor. Number 1, they must be accurate. Number 2, they must prepare your tax returns as well as advise you on your tax strategy. Number 3, they should reduce your taxes as they prepare your tax return. And number 4, they should reduce your chances of being audited. Now that you have all of this knowledge about how to reduce your taxes, what are you going to do next? You should work with your tax advisor to put all of this advice to good use and reduce your taxes right away. This will immediately increase your cash flow. Just think about what you can do with all that extra money. In the next chapter, we'll talk about how you can use that extra cash flow to massively increase your wealth. Here are this chapter's key points. Number 1, the tax law is intentionally vague and allows for great flexibility if you know what it says and how to bend it. Number 2, one of the most important things you'll ever do to protect your wealth is to find not just a good, but a great tax advisor and preparer. Number 3, the best tax advisors have a vast understanding of the tax law, can think non-linearly, and are passionately concerned about your needs. And number 4, never use a tax preparer that isn't also your tax advisor. You may otherwise get great advice that is never used and lose out on great tax savings. Tax strategy number 23, hiring the right tax advisor. Here are the top 10 things to talk about when interviewing a tax advisor. Number 1, what is your view of the tax law? Number 2, who gets the most advantages of the tax law? Number 3, what made you want to become a tax advisor? Number 4, what would you like to know about me? Number 5, tell me about your team of advisors. Number 6, describe your personal business experience. Number 7, tell me about your personal investment strategy. Number 8, where did you earn your Master's of Tax degree? Number 9, give me 3 examples of how to reduce the risk of an IRS audit. And number 10, tell me your thoughts about asset protection. Here are the top 10 things your prospective tax advisor should discuss with you. Number 1, tell me about your dreams and goals. Number 2, describe your current and projected family situation. Number 3, describe your relationship with your spouse and your children. Number 4, describe your current and projected investments. Number 5, describe your current and projected business situation. Number 6, explain your philosophy of tax reduction. Number 7, what would you like to learn about the tax laws? Number 8, how do you learn best? Auditory, visual, tactile, or kinesthetic? Number 9, in a perfect world, how would you like to work with your CPA? And number 10, who are the other members of your team?
Andy Tanner, Rich Dad Advisor on Paper Assets. Personal background and entrepreneur profile. Name, Andy Tanner. Date of birth, May 10th, 1968. Place of birth, Murray, Utah. Traditional education, Snow College, Ephraim, Utah. University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah. Weber State University, Ogden, Utah. Associates of Science, quit school 12 hours shy of a bachelor's degree. Professional education, none. Grade point averages, high school, 2.36, college, 2.58. Value of traditional education relative to becoming an entrepreneur. My experience in athletics while attending traditional schools was very valuable. Through athletics, I began to experience important life lessons, such as mission, leadership, and team. I can't really judge the classroom fairly because it was not interesting to me. I wasn't very interested in the topics they taught, so I did not study much. I really don't know if it would have helped me or not. I'm sure I could have found some good in each class if I had looked harder, but I lacked the maturity to do so. Additionally, none of the career choices that traditional school prepares you for resonated with me, and none felt like a calling. Subject I like most in school: phys ed and choir. Phys ed was where my natural talents were. Although I consider myself to be intelligent, I never enjoyed the process of classroom and book learning that focused on taking tests. Additionally, I can't really sing, but I'm glad my parents made me take choir. Leland Flinders was an extraordinary choral teacher. My suspicion is that he was out of the rat race because he did not teach for money. He taught because he loved music and students. It was his calling. Each year he would teach us students to raise money for an annual senior trip to Hawaii to compete in a choral competition. He demanded hard work and maturity from all of us who wanted to participate. All that work paid off, because in 1986, we won the gold medal at that Hawaiian competition. To this day, it is one of my best memories from school. Subject I hated most in school: organic chemistry. First entrepreneurial project. In 1996, I started FamilyParade.com. It was a social networking site like Facebook. I very much wish I would have known what a BI triangle was back then. The key entrepreneurial skill I was not taught in school: leadership and sales. Why and when I became an entrepreneur and my first major venture. I could not find anything I truly enjoyed other than playing sports. I floundered in some low-paying jobs after I quit school, and then discovered I had a love for speaking and teaching. I got into the seminar industry and loved it. The pay was pretty good, and inspiring people brought a lot of satisfaction. I learned about stocks because, many years ago, I was asked to teach that topic at a seminar. I started my own education company and created my own artifacts because I love teaching, and I think that's my calling. It is what I'm supposed to do in life. Best lesson from first business: it is okay to fail. It hurts, but it's not terminal. What I learned about myself from my Kolbe Index. Please see companion file number 19. First, I learned to embrace my nature instead of fighting to change it. Secondly, I learned to embrace the natures of others and not expect them to change. And third, I realized how my Kolbe and my wife's Kolbe complement each other. My role in the BI triangle. My role is to stay focused on mission and communicate to my team. Skills that are essential for entrepreneurs but not taught in schools. 1. Leadership. I love to speak and teach to help people. This is a part of leadership that I feel comfortable with. Yet I'm still learning how to be a better leader, and it's a skill I'm still developing. Through my own failures in the past, and also the challenges I face today, I realize that leadership is a never-ending process of development and not a final destination. 2. Teamwork. Like most people, my time in school made me feel as if I was competing as an individual against my classmates. In hindsight, I can see how this method of teaching robs us of learning how to work as a team. Through athletics, choir, my rock band, and business, I now love being part of a team. My most important lesson for entrepreneurs: spirit. I still consider myself a student. I still make mistakes. I still have challenges. Some days as an entrepreneur are very tough, and there's always a battle of some kind to fight. Having an entrepreneur's spirit is not just about having an enthusiasm for freedom or money. I've learned that it is about having a spirit to serve others, to create value for others, and to keep learning year after year. How I learned to raise capital. As I stand with the other Rich Dad advisors, I am in awe of the expertise of Kenny, Josh and Lisa, and Darren when it comes to raising capital. I'm not in their league, yet I have also discovered that there are many people with a lot of money who are looking for places to invest. Knowing that, I can serve these people by having a good investment opportunity for them and by clearly communicating the potential and risks to these investors. Some business people are better at creating opportunities. Others are better at communicating the opportunity. This is where I have to be very careful, because I can easily use my communication skills to raise a lot of capital. In fact, I often have people approach me wanting me to take their money. For me, raising capital goes beyond the ability to get people to hand over their cash. It is about creating an investor opportunity that is worth investing in. I've watched other people raise money easily, only to lose that money for the investor. How I learned to overcome fear and failure. I'm still learning to overcome fear and failure. Every now and then, I still get scared to make certain moves. Like everyone else, sometimes I also fear failure. It's something I'm comfortable telling you because I'm human. Even so, there have been times in my life when I have summoned great courage. I've still felt the fear, but calling upon my inner strength has allowed me to move forward anyway. One of my secret weapons to overcome my individual fears is to surround myself with a great team. I also find that when I focus on my mission and its value to others, I always seem to summon courage to tackle anything. When I have goals worth fighting for, the fear of the fight diminishes. One good example was writing my first book about the problems with 401k plans. I was nervous about how it would be received because I knew I was going against the entrenched thinking of what the government, Wall Street, and society have been advising for decades. I had fears of one-star ratings on Amazon. But when I thought of all the people who would be hurt by the 401k system, it gave me courage to speak up and pull no punches. Ultimately, my family gave me the most strength to fight this fear, because I want to create the best life I can give them. There have been times when I've been afraid, but my love for them has driven me past fear. My personal strength. I can say with total confidence that I am one of the best teachers in the world. I can take difficult topics such as stock investing and make it simple and fun to learn. This is the most valuable service I can offer the Rich Dad Advisor team as we support the Rich Dad mission. My personal weakness. Sometimes I think our culture encourages us to downplay our individual skills and accomplishments. This can result in diminishing the way we view ourselves and how we measure our self-worth. Sometimes I fall victim to this myself. While I definitely know my strengths, occasionally I allow my brain to cancel it out with feelings of weakness. When we let the feelings of low self-worth overpower our thoughts, I believe it can prevent us from unleashing our full power. So it's a battle that we all must fight every day. The entrepreneurial skills I teach best. Communication and resilience. The entrepreneurial lesson I teach. Paper assets, strategies for investing in all market conditions and managing risks. Paper Assets, Strategies for Investing and Managing Risk by Andy Tanner. Market crashes make the rich richer and the poor and middle class poorer. Andy is a member of my team because you need to know how to make money when markets are going up and especially when markets are going down. Robert T. Kiyosaki. My role on the Rich Dad Advisor team plays to my strengths, and that is teaching people about paper assets. I'm not surprised when I hear from students that when they increase their knowledge in any of the asset classes, in this case paper assets, it also helps prepare them and inspire them to invest in other asset classes. By playing Robert's Cashflow 101 game, people instinctively and intuitively learn about a fancy investing term called fundamental analysis. Fundamental analysis is the process of understanding a financial statement, along with assessments of the strengths and weaknesses associated with that statement. I teach thousands of students each year, and my favorite students are those who have already become familiar with the financial statement by playing the cash flow game. This exposure makes it much easier to introduce them to real financial statements on the personal level, the family level, as well as the corporate level. This is important when researching a stock to buy or even understanding what's happening with the financial health of a country that can affect the global markets. Entrepreneurs want to learn fundamental analysis so they can evaluate the strength of their own company or the potential of other opportunities in which they might invest. In Cashflow 202, investors are introduced to market trends. When I have the occasion to speak at Robert's side to a group of entrepreneurs or inspiring investors, he often asks me to teach them about trends. Entrepreneurs want to be aware of trends because that's where the market is heading. Trends can go up, trends can go down, and trends can even remain stagnant, what we call a sideways trend. The best part is that no matter what direction the trend is heading, there are good investing opportunities available for educated investors to profit. The study of trends is called technical analysis. Entrepreneurs have the job of solving problems so that they can create value and profit relative to any trend, up, down, or sideways. In order to benefit, though, the investor must be able to identify the trend and have a way to determine if and when that trend will change direction. In a nutshell, fundamental analysis and technical analysis are about gathering information and then analyzing it in order to understand what is happening. Once a person has this information and has analyzed it looking for opportunity, the next step is to turn it into cash flow. When it comes to paper assets, there are many ways investors can do this, and many of these methods go beyond the run-of-the-mill, tried-and-true, buy-low-and-sell-high that most people are familiar with. Entrepreneurs can learn how to take a position to generate profits based on the information they have gathered. Some people might take a position for capital gain, traditional buy and hold, while others might take a position for cash flow, earn money no matter what happens in the market. I love to educate people on the various positions an investor can take with paper assets, because gaining this education and then applying what they learn can give anyone more control over their investments and more effectively manage risk. This brings us to the fourth thing I love to teach about paper assets. It's called risk management. One of the beefs that I have with the 401k retirement plans is the tremendous amount of risk that is piled on the investor, yet they have virtually no control of that investment to manage the risk. Even if a person is diversified across the stock market, they're still susceptible to a stock market crash, a crash they cannot control. Risk management means that once a person has done their fundamental analysis, their technical analysis, and decides what type of position they want to take, they get to play the devil's advocate. Entrepreneurs always ask what-if questions so that they have a plan B or even a plan C if markets change unexpectedly. This is not much different than buying insurance on your house. Insurance allows you to be compensated in case your house burns down due to something that was beyond your control, such as a mischievous neighbor kid playing with matches. These four areas, fundamental analysis, technical analysis, positions for cash flow, and risk management, make up what I call my four pillars of investing. I hope you'll keep in mind that these ideas and concepts are not just for people who invest in paper assets. I know that Robert owns some paper assets, but the majority of his holdings are in oil, real estate, and business. Nonetheless, Robert cares about studying fundamentals and trends. What makes education on paper assets vital, I believe, is that it's an asset class in which most people have invested their money. I would venture to say that many people are looking to have their retirement funded by the value of their 401k account, which is made up of mutual funds they've dumped their money in for years and sometimes decades. What's ironic to me is that paper assets are an area with massive participation, yet with almost no education. Let me say that again so I can emphasize it. Paper assets are an asset class with massive participation, but almost no one has been educated on how to understand or manage these investments. In most cases, 401k participants hand over a portion of their paycheck to a financial planner or 401k administrator and let them worry about it. I see this as a massive risk for everyone with a 401k account. That's why I am committed to doing all I can to make education related to paper assets and the stock market simple and fun for those who care to learn more about this important topic. Another thing Robert often asks me to discuss and teach related to paper assets is what this asset class brings to the table for investors like you and me. I've always avoided placing one asset class above another because I think it's a matter of personal preference instead of an issue of good or better. Anyone who bashes real estate has to explain the success of Donald Trump. Anyone who bashes the energy industry has to explain the success of T. Boone Pickens. Anyone who bashes business as being too risky has to explain the success of Sir Richard Branson. And anyone who wants to bash paper assets must first explain the success of the greatest investor of all time, Warren Buffett, who makes billions of dollars a year in paper assets. More intelligent discussion related to asset classes might focus on the differences among the asset classes and what each brings to the table in terms of strengths and weaknesses, the pros and cons. As I've discussed, this is something Robert often asks me to explain when I'm teaching about paper assets. In the rich dad world, diversification is across asset classes, not across stocks or mutual funds. Paper assets are liquid. This can be good and bad. It's good in that you can turn something into cash almost instantly if you see a better opportunity, or if you see danger where your money is currently invested. If you don't like what you see, you can simply click a button and you're out. If you see the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, you can click a button and you're into a new investment in no time at all. The downside of liquidity is volatility. This is why you see the stock market's gyrations are much more violent when compared to some other markets. Liquidity gives speed to the supply and demand in the market. That lends itself to incredible booms and earth-shattering busts. Paper assets are agile. I mentioned earlier that one of the entrepreneurial skills I teach is the ability to identify trends. Paper assets are one of the most welcoming investments when it comes to finding success in a downward trending market. George Soros, an expert in identifying trends, has become famous largely because of the billions he's been able to make by identifying down trends. In 2013, for example, George Soros made over $1 billion by taking a bearish position on the Japanese yen, while anyone who was saving yen in a savings account lost purchasing power and value. George Soros, in essence, was borrowing Japanese yen and found tremendous success doing so. Being able to realize a profit or generate cash flow in something that is losing value is a difficult idea for beginning investors to wrap their heads around. Yet it is an important entrepreneurial skill that can keep money flowing into your account no matter what is happening in the market. My job is to make understanding this kind of skill easy, simple, and fun to learn. Paper assets are scalable. This is another reason I absolutely love teaching people about paper assets. I know there are many people who have read the book Rich Dad Poor Dad, but have yet to buy their first rental property or start their first business. I know many of these people would like to have something in their asset column, but for whatever reason, they don't have it yet. Paper assets are an amazing way to start, because anyone can purchase many of the same assets that are owned by Warren Buffett, even if you're not a billionaire. For example, Warren Buffett owns millions of shares of the Coca-Cola company. My sons can earn enough money from their lemonade stand to purchase some shares of the Coca-Cola company as well. They'll even receive a percent return, similar to Warren Buffett's, just on a smaller scale. More importantly, they can learn many of the same lessons because they're the same kinds of investments. If someone has played cash flow and now wants to play the game for real, paper assets allow someone to do that on a small scale, but still be very much in the stock market game, just like in the cash flow game. But don't get me wrong here. Investing in real paper requires real money, real risk, and the possibility of real loss. But the idea that a person can scale it down to where those losses are minimal can help people learn large lessons without large risk or losses. Paper assets give you leverage. In real estate, the main lever is debt. That's a good thing. In paper, often the main lever is simply a contract. This is also a very good thing. When I first teach people about the options market and they learn how to be a seller of a contract for cash flow, it blows their minds. Selling agreements is an entrepreneurial skill that can be learned and experienced easily in the options market. Taking on massive amounts of real estate debt without proper education and mentorship is unwise, even though it's a good thing for those who are educated and skilled. The exact same thing is true for paper assets. It is extremely risky to begin selling options contracts, even those that can be covered with stocks, without proper knowledge and mentorship. In my home country, the predominant retirement program for people in the E quadrant is called the 401k. In Canada, it's called the RRSP. In Australia, it's called superannuation. And in Japan, it's also called a 401k. No matter where you live in the world, it's essential to learn about the types of programs that are designed for people in the E quadrant. The Rich Dad mission is about elevating the well-being of humanity through financial education. A large percentage of this population still lives in the E quadrant, and in order to improve their lives, I feel a responsibility to tell them about paper assets in a way that the average financial advisor might not. Even if a person decides to remain in the E quadrant and not become an entrepreneur, I still believe they can benefit from financial education on investments like mutual funds or unit trusts. I believe there are massive risks that they are not aware of. I also believe that some of the big picture fundamental data we see points to some rough waters ahead for these good people in the E quadrant who are clinging to their mutual funds like life preservers. I'm not saying that mutual funds or unit trusts are a bad investment. What I am saying is to become educated so you can make better decisions for yourself and your family. I love teaching people about paper assets. I love learning and teaching in general and consider myself a student as well as a teacher. As a Rich Dad advisor, I think people sometimes see me as someone who has arrived and has all of the answers. One thing I've learned by spending a lot of time with Robert and the other advisors is that we're all students. We study more than most people think or believe. It's one of the most important ways I learn important new things. And I've learned more as a teacher than I ever did as a student. Here is my final thought to anyone who wishes to be an entrepreneur. This process means you are also becoming a student as a result of your desire to solve problems and give value to the world. Focus on this, and your future will be very bright indeed. About Andy Tanner. Andy Tanner is a renowned paper assets expert and successful business owner and investor, known for his ability to teach key techniques for stock options investing. He serves as a coach to Rich Dad Stock Success System trainers and as the Rich Dad Advisor for paper assets. As a highly sought-after educator, Andy has taught tens of thousands of investors and entrepreneurs around the world. He often speaks to students at the request of Robert Kiyosaki, showing how paper assets can fit into the Rich Dad system of investing. In 2008, Andy played a key role in developing and launching Rich Dad Stock Success System, a program created to teach investors advanced technical trading techniques for profiting in both bull and bear markets. He is the author of two books, 401 Chaos and Stock Market Cash Flow, a Rich Dad Advisor series book on paper asset investing. And he has also created an online investing course called The Four Pillars of Investing. You can find out more about it at www.fourpillarsofinvesting.com. For books by Andy Tanner, please see companion file number 20. An excerpt from Stock Market Cash Flow, Four Pillars of Investing for Thriving in Today's Markets by Andy Tanner.
Chapter 3, Introducing the Four Pillars of Investing. Let me introduce you to the Four Pillars of Investing. As a student, you will find that everything you will ever learn about making money with stocks will fit into one of these four pillars. In Chapter 2, we described wealth building as learning to buy or create assets intelligently. We also saw that the asset classes include business, real estate, commodities, and paper assets such as stocks and options. We learned that each asset class has its own language and nuances. So, how do you learn to buy these things intelligently? How do you make sound decisions when an opportunity presents itself? The answer is in learning the four pillars of investing. These pillars contain vital information for every type of investor in any asset class, and they are vital for whether you are investing for capital gains or cash flow. In preparing to write this book, I sat down and reviewed everything I had ever learned from my mentors and teachers about investing. I realized that everything I knew fit nicely into four categories. 1. I had learned about studying entities, fundamental analysis. 2. I had learned how to study trends, technical analysis. 3. I had learned techniques to position myself for profit, cash flow. 4. I had learned about managing risk, risk management. These categories make up what I call my four pillars of investing. When you dedicate yourself to studying these four pillars, you will learn the criteria that will allow you to look at any investment opportunity in any asset class and make better decisions. The four pillars will support your financial education goals. You will learn to buy assets intelligently and build wealth. So let's get started by looking at pillar number 1. Pillar 1, fundamental analysis. Fundamental analysis examines the strength of an entity. We need to be able to tell the difference between an entity that is strong and an entity that is weak, be that entity a private company, a charity, even a nation. And we do that by looking at financial statements. The financial statement tells us the strength of an entity. My college basketball coach was a master when it came to teaching fundamentals. His teams won many championships, and he was well known among avid college basketball fans. People often ask me why I think he was so successful. My answer is always the same. He absolutely demanded perfection in the parts of the game that don't require talent, but do require tremendous effort. Not everyone has the same level of talent, but we all can give supreme effort. There are certain parts of the game that are basic at any level, be it high school or the pros. To have success, you must be proficient in them. My coach was obsessed with the fundamentals, and he coached them well. The same rigor in fundamentals is needed for financial success, and the basic rules apply to every entity, from sovereign governments to corporations to individuals. There are certain financial fundamentals that must be in line for any entity to flourish. In this chapter, you will begin to understand what these fundamentals are. You will also discover how to compare one entity to another and immediately know which one is in a stronger financial position. Fundamental analysis is the process of looking at some basic numbers and evaluating the financial strength of the entity based on those numbers. I'm going to help you discover what those numbers mean and where you can find them. You're going to discover that as you learn more about how to look at these fundamental numbers, you'll have an increased ability to make wise investment decisions. You'll be able to set a bar for comparison and then quickly see if the opportunity measures up with your expectation of a good investment. One helpful way to look at fundamental analysis is to think of it as going to the doctor for a checkup. To analyze your condition, the doctor begins with the basics. She's probably not concerned with the color of your hair or the color of your eyes. These things don't tell the doctor very much about how healthy you are, but she will check your blood pressure and your pulse. She'll tap on your knee to see if your reflexes are responding properly. She'll use a stethoscope to listen to the beat of your heart and the sound of your lungs. She'll write down your vital signs. These vital signs represent the fundamental state of your basic health. Collecting and analyzing these numbers is the doctor's first step in figuring out what's happening with your overall system. When it comes to analyzing a nation's economy or your own financial standing, conducting a fundamental analysis as the first step will give you a quick understanding of financial fitness to see if everything is in order. The financial vital signs can tell us a lot about the health of an entity. Fundamental analysis also helps us determine value. The more financially healthy the entity, the more valuable it is in the marketplace. Fundamental analysis is a critical tool for leaders of all kinds. It can be used to discover weakness and, in turn, guide policies for improvement, whether it is being used at the highest levels of government or for a couple at the head of a household. It is a very valuable diagnostic tool. As we study fundamentals, you will learn 1. How to measure the financial strength of any entity. 2. How to see the value of the entity. 3. How to diagnose causes of weakness. 4. How to change policies to fix weakness and predict change. 5. How to see the two sides of any transaction and identify the winner and the loser. 6. Why it seems that investors can predict the future. Now those are things I wish I could have learned in school. Pillar 2, technical analysis. The second of the four pillars is called technical analysis. Technicals for short. Technicals are the story of supply and demand in pictures. Supply and demand creates trends. Picture yourself as the owner of a golf course. You've done a great job with every part of your business. Your course is one of the best golf properties anywhere in the world. In fact, there are so many people who want to play on your golf course that there's no way you can accommodate everyone. You've earned the luxury of being in high demand. As a result, tee times on the course are in short supply. What does this mean to your business? Now you can charge more than your competitors because there's a higher demand for a tee time at your course than anywhere else. On your computer, you have a chart that shows the history of your prices as they've climbed year after year. Using this trend, you can forecast where your prices are and likely to be in the future. This process of examining a chart and projecting what you expect to happen in the future is called technical analysis. When you buy a share of stock in a company, it makes sense that you will want to carefully examine at least two things. One, since you're going to own a share of the company, it feels very natural to want to know how strong the company is financially and how it stacks up against other companies when it comes to the basic numbers or fundamental analysis. Two, You want to see how eager other investors are to buy shares in the company and if there's a high demand for the shares that could drive the company's stock price higher and higher, or technical analysis. It is very important to understand trends because you will see that, with the stock market, opportunity is always present. In the